Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I am John Ash. With us today is Jimmy Bogard. Jimmy is the chief architect at Headspring, author of MVC in Action books, international speaker, prolific OSS developer. He is an expert in distributed systems, REST, messaging, domain-driven design, and CQRS. Welcome, Jimmy.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
So, Jimmy, what are you working on these days?
Oh, gosh. So these days, I work for a consulting company here in Austin, Texas. And so I'm usually involved in kind of the beginning of our larger projects to help. It's like, see where the company is today and then figure out how they need to get to where they need to be. So my last two clients were insurance companies. Both with large existing legacy systems, and at the beginnings of looking to see how do we get off of the legacy system and what does it look like going forward. One of them had a COBOL mainframe about 40 years old, with 5 million lines of COBOL in it. And the other one was a newer one, but still a ton of custom code, and just figuring out like, how do we can't go as fast as we want to be. How do we go forward? How do we get off of this? So that's mainly what I do is work with larger customers to figure out how to take something big and break it down into smaller, more nimble things, which I think we're calling microservices now, but whatever.
So how did you get started in the industry?
By accident, probably. It's the same with a lot of folks. So I actually graduated with a degree in electrical engineering. But when I graduated, there were basically no jobs in that industry whatsoever. It was in a really big downturn of like semiconductor manufacturing and things like that, that basically no one was hiring. I think half my graduating class from here at Texas didn't have a job coming out of school. So I had to find something to do. And I had done a few just side gigs of building websites for people using FrontPage 2000, of course. So I was like, well, someone's hiring a web developer. And so I just got started doing that. I started working for a product company here in town. And just kind of went from there, like a lot of people just building websites for fun and like, oh, this actually pays pretty well. And everybody needs software. So I don't have to worry about like industry downturns. Like, don't really have to worry about that for software development. So just kind of fell into it like a lot of other folks, I think.
Very nice.
One of the things you're well known for is Automapper. Maybe we could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Famous or infamous, one of the two. I don't know.
Well, actually, I've heard even recently, I don't know if it was a Twitter or maybe some of your blog posts, maybe even questioning whether feeling a little bit resentment for even writing it. Or is that the case? Or what is the story there?
Yeah, it's had a long history now because the library is almost 10 years old, maybe around 10 years old at this point. And it started out to solve a specific problem we were going to have in a project that I was a tech lead on. And so I built something to solve that problem and thought it might be useful to others. So released it as an open source project. We even had a discussion in our company very early on. I mean, this was back in those days, like open source wasn't the go-to thing people did in the Microsoft world, of course, right? Like there were open source projects, of course, at that time, but this was before Microsoft really open sourced anything of significance. So even like ASP.NET MVC at the time wasn't open source. It took a while for that to happen. So we were, well, what do we do with this? Do we sell it? Do we like, no? I mean, we were a consulting company. We really didn't want to do like, selling libraries. It's just a totally different business model. So we said, well, let's just make it open source. And that way we can at least use it in the next project. That was the biggest motivation. It's not, if I make it open source, then I can continue to build upon it, and then we can continue to use it for future clients. So that was the biggest motivation. But yeah, it was something to solve a very specific problem in a very specific kind of design set of design constraints. And I guess over the years, of course, I've gone through different phases of saying, well, let's try to add a bunch of new features to see if I can use it for a lot of other things. And then realizing later, like, oh, that was a dumb idea. Now people are abusing it, whatever. They're trying to use it for a lot of different things that it wasn't ever really designed for. So it's kind of this pendulum back and forth of adding a lot of things and then like, oops, that's too much junk that we don't even use. And then constraining it a lot and then people complaining because I just took away a lot of things that they were depending on. So I don't know. I'm kind of back in the swing of like taking away things so I don't have to deal with GitHub issues. I used to actually subscribe to the Stack Overflow tag, but it's just depressing. I'm like, basically all my answers is like, please don't use it for this. Please don't use it for this. Like just hand roll that code. It's yeah. I just keeps going back and forth like that. So we still use it though for all of our projects because we still use those. We still do the design that it was originally designed for. This whole idea of having new models per view or having API models if we're doing API based stuff. So it's still pretty valuable for us. But I think we use just a very small fraction of the things that are available in there. To make sure we don't get kind of trouble for doing crazy stuff. So
from a consulting perspective, how has been supporting that? I mean, you obviously are saying you're swinging back and forth, but I'm kind of more curious about that. I work in consulting as well. And I know John does as well. So we have a history and I'm sure that we have a lot of people that kind of are in that same gig, but there is an interesting conundrum that you have when you're working consulting and you come up with a solution that it's like, okay, well this we could build the solution for this customer, or we could build this generic solution that we could then take forward. How has open sourcing Automapper worked for you guys, and is that kind of met your needs, or has that become a whole nother pain, or are you the only one dealing with that pain? From the company is like, well, we don't care.
No, it is basically me, because I mean, I feel like who supports Automapper? It's basically myself, and we do have a few like large contributors now. I've been lucky enough, at least in that project, that people I've never met have actually stepped in to help with help supporting it, which basically means like reviewing pull requests, issues and pull requests. Those are the biggest. Like someone else can get the internet points on Stack Overflow. I don't want to deal with that. I just deal with the big picture things of major decisions on design or features that should be in there. In terms of company, based on that experience, we've tried to do that with other libraries. We just see the value that if there's some kind of code that is not domain specific to or IP, you know, a very IP specific to a company. And we look at, okay, how can we take that out and use in the next one? The pitch being to our customers that, hey, our solution is built on top of a lot of things that we've delivered for other customers. So it's kind of a pay it forward. Our customers don't actually pay for the development of it. So we use like non-billable time, but then we'll, it is still a conversation to say, this part, there's an open source project that we just made 2 hours ago that is it looks like a great fit for what you're doing. But for a lot of ours, though, it does take a long time for code to kind of marinate and graduate as an open source project. So the other big one that I do is Mediator. And that was about 5 years of internal use before my boss at the time was like, Jimmy, why don't you make an open source project of that? And he had to convince me. It was like 6 months of him badgering me before I'm like, okay, fine, let's open source this, because I just was, at that point, I was tired of then copying that code from basically code base to code base. I didn't think it was only like 100 lines of code to begin with, so I thought there's no point. But we've looked for more opportunistic things based on those two projects to see, now we have a kind of internal review board that's looking at interesting things going on in projects. Are there things that are worth pulling out? So a lot of my other open source stuff is around there now, of looking at solutions that could be genericized, kind of rewritten, genericized, and then released as open source. They may not be as popular as Automapper Mediator, but that's okay. Like if we can use it on the next one, help deliver for our clients faster, that's really the important thing.
So for those not familiar with Mediator, You want to give us just a high level overview of what that is?
Sure. You can tell by the name about what time, like what year it was first released, because I'm so bad at naming things. So I looked at SignalR. I was like, oh, Mediator. It's just an implementation of the mediator pattern. And the basic idea of the mediator pattern is, instead of you calling into objects directly to be able to perform work, you have something that acts as an intermediary between you and that other thing. So this came about really when we were building a lot of CQRS-based systems, that you have this idea that you have requests in your applications that are generally commands or queries. And we wanted to disconnect the kind of main logic or the main controller from the work that was to be done. So we use the mediator pattern as a means to encapsulate, I'm sending a request down to some actually business logic, and I'm going to get some response back entirely in memory in process. So that was just an implementation of that pattern. Another big thing I wanted to do was not tie myself to one specific container, because Mediator does use dependency injection for instantiating the handlers of a request. And a lot of the solutions at the time were very much tied to one specific dependency injection library, which was annoying because I didn't really want to have to maintain. Someone bumped the version, so now I got to go bump my version as well. So I wanted to make something that was completely divorced from any existing dependency injection container. So for that, we use, again, on almost all of our systems, because almost all our systems have some kind of user interacts with them and in some kind of synchronous fashion. So I need something to encapsulate requests and responses or commands and queries. So whether it's like thick client desktop app or stateless web APIs, everything has this kind of request response. And so we use that as a means to encapsulate request responses and handlers in our systems. And it makes it super easy to build and test because everything goes in through one input and one output. So everything talks that language.
Very cool. Yeah, it's I haven't got a chance to use it much, but my company has actually been pulling it and using it pretty heavily. I have actually sort of transitioned less of the development and into more of a DevOps role, so I haven't got to play with the code quite to the same degree, but it really is. We found it immensely helpful, and I don't know, as awesome as many people find Automapper, I think Mediator is probably one of the most productive tools that you've been a part of kind of putting out there.
Which is, it's funny that you say that, because for us it's the same thing. Like Automapper is just a kind of a handy tool, but for us, Mediator is something that really transformed how we build our systems. And we've been using that pattern for a while. I mean, the same project that built Automapper also created a form of this Mediator, and you can actually find it. And there's a very old open source project called MVC Contrib, and our version of that made it into MVC Contrib. But it was like way too much because it was for what that project needed. And so it took a while for us to pare down to something that's much simpler, had a lot fewer assumptions, and that's what eventually came into Mediator. And then, yeah, like you said, it's that for us has just provided a lot of value, just because we use it to implement CQRS in almost all of our projects by just having something that can explicitly model commands and queries as first-class citizens in our applications. So while I know a lot of people, I've heard like two or three folks say like, oh, I built that Automapper. I've heard like 100 people say I've also built Mediator. So I can't certainly I didn't invent the pattern or the implementation. It's just nice to have something that I can constantly use in my projects without having to copy that code anymore.
And their implementations certainly don't have the same catchy names.
No, and I got a logo too. Someone submitted a pull request like, here, I made a logo for you. Like, wow, I didn't ask for it, but thank you.
And you also do a fair amount of speaking and writing on domain-driven design. It seems like all of this is kind of wrapped up in the same roles, right? Is this just a function of how you do your work and how you implement solutions?
Pretty much. Or at least I've been involved in domain-driven design since like maybe 2005-ish or so. Since I didn't actually graduate with a CS degree, I had this For the first 5 years of my career, I had this like huge, huge imposter syndrome, because I knew I didn't know what I was doing. And so at the time, I just, you know, whatever I could get my hands on to read about, you know, how people actually do software development in the real world, versus things like just, you know, I had the algorithms book, I had the data structures books, and like, this didn't tell me how to solve customers' problems. So very early on, I was looking at how does the real world actually build software? So that really turned me on to the Fowler books, and then domain-driven design as well. So I've been involved in domain-driven design since very early on in my career, and it's really colored how I think about systems, especially trying to model systems based on the language and model that the business users actually have. Because I've been involved in a few projects where there's always this translation between developers and the business. You know, we call it an order, but the business calls it an invoice. Like, well, why don't we call it the same thing? And so part of that becomes how users, modeling the interactions users have in the real world in the systems that I build. So looking at, you know, getting away from, for example, screens that are just, you know, editing an invoice. It's like, I need to approve an invoice. So you go edit the invoice and set its status to approved, versus having a screen that's, here are all the unapproved invoices or open invoices. And there's a button that says approve. And then that form that pops up is only the information that you need to approve an invoice. And so when it comes time to actually modeling the software for that, then I actually have a request that is to approve the invoice, and then something that handles that request as well. So as we move towards more task-based UIs, and really modeling the business based on their actual interactions and what they were doing, then that naturally led into things like CQRS and then Mediator as well.
Yeah, and you mentioned that you don't necessarily have a CS background. I was in a CS program, but ended up not completing that and moving into the business world and just kind of learning on the job. You know, it seems like a lot of CS programs, or at least in my experience, teach a lot of theory, and I think it's very good. And a lot of the books out there teach a lot of theory, and it's very good. But it's very difficult to, like you said, find out how people write websites or write applications and implement the theory that they may have learned. We often are learning on the job and as we go, and you're kind of a slave to the patterns that you're exposed to, whether that be an existing application or just whatever you came across on Stack Overflow. Mm-hmm. How would you recommend, or how have you gone about learning these good patterns and better implementations and domain-driven design and CQRS and those types of things?
Well, I get to talk about where I built up a lot of my knowledge from, and that it'll probably be different today because, you know, just the resources available today versus then are quite a bit different. Like I got started, there's no such thing as Pluralsight at all. Like, there's nothing close to that. So a lot of what I had to build from had to be from books. And so that's where, even today, I get most of my research and knowledge from, is just reading a lot of books. So early on, it's like I graduated with a double E with a focus on computer engineering. So like, there was computers involved, but it was basically like programming FPGAs, hand compiling C to assembly, which I never want to ever do again. And just like very, very low level stuff. So like my senior project was to design a maze solving robot. So like going like a, it was on a Frisbee and it would go through a maze. It had to design an algorithm to do that. When I started building web apps, it's like, there's none of that really translated. The technical side of things, but a lot of the problem solving stuff did. So breaking down a problem from, you know, very macro goal, solving a robot, you know, solving a maze, and then going and, you know, iterating in the designs, even the things like TDD, that was baked in from the start from engineering, because everything we built, we had to have built-in self-test. Like I need to be able to push a button and it needs to tell me whether it's working or not. Every single component, because it sucks if it's broken and you have to get out the little voltmeter and be like, is this thing broken? Is that thing broken? Like, that sucks. So that foundation, the engineering foundation, was huge. But then from the software side, I was trying to find people that were more grounded in the practical side of things. Like, how do people actually build applications? So I gravitated towards those kind of things. Like, I never owned or read the Gang of Four book, the Patterns book. What I did read, though, was the book about refactoring to patterns, which I don't know if that's a thing people read these days, but for me, being in an object-oriented language in C#, it's like the patterns are still important because I'll have code and it's like, that's ugly. I need to fix it, but how? Like, what do I fix it to? What options are available to me? So for me, the things that were most important were the refactoring books to say, how do we get from point A to point B in a safe, methodical manner, having that pattern language as well. So the patterns books, the refactoring books, those are really foundational for me. And in particular, it'd be Fowler's refactoring book, which he does have an updated version. The refactoring the patterns book, because refactoring is great for code on the small, but then once they have larger patterns in place, then those refactoring the patterns book was great for that. So I can see like this giant switch statement. How do I fix this? Well, I have a playbook to tell me what's possible for me. Fowler's other book, The Patterns of Enterprise Application Architecture. I was using a lot of libraries, but I didn't understand why these libraries look like this. Using something like Inhibernate back in the day, why does this thing exist? What problems does it solve? And then having books these are the patterns that this library actually implements. And then of course, I guess Uncle Bob's book, the
PPP patterns principles.
Yes. And then finally the DDD book. So I wound up actually hosting a book club over 10 years ago here in Austin, just trying to get people that are reading this book, and it's quite dense. So just trying to get other people from other backgrounds, just discuss how they might apply these principles. Those are the really big ones for me that help me get started.
Yeah. And I'll second that the Gang of Four patterns book is a tough, tough read. I wholly recommend the Head First Design Patterns book with mm-hmm. examples in Java, because that one's is so much easier to read and it's so much lighter in concept and implementation.
Yeah, you can always tell the newbie that's read the Gang of Four book for the first time, because you see their code, it's like you're like trying to follow a checklist. Like, well, the only one they don't have is the bridge pattern, which is it looks like reads like a checklist. Yeah, I've heard great things about that one. I don't know if that book existed when I was getting started. So something like, because I got started in the early 2000s, mid 2000s. Yeah, just a lot of those nicer things weren't there. And these days, I mean, there's so many resources available for you if you want to get started. Then the tough part becomes just getting experience to know when not to use certain things. So that was a big part of my career too, is just pushing things really far and then realizing like this is the limit, and then walking it back to something that's a little bit more reasonable.
So on that, do you have any good examples that come to your head or any kind of wisdom that you can kind of share from moments where you've gone too far and you went, wait a second, I need to walk this back?
So one of my first projects, and I think I have even a talk on this, because all my talks, by the way, are just, if I ever do a conference presentation, it's always just something, some experience that I've had. I'm not good about teaching other people something new or interesting. It's just like, here's all the mistakes I've made and here's what I've learned. And one of the ones I had was the same project that created AutoMapper and the very earlier version of Mediator. Was a large government project in which we used a lot of the kind of solid design principles at the time. So like lots of interior architecture, that sort of thing. And so we took that to its, like we took it to its all the way to its bitter conclusion. Because it's what everyone, it's what everyone was doing at the time, right? Like everyone's creating these heavily layered architectures. We have controllers, talk to services, talk to repositories and that sort of thing. So we took that all the way to the end just realized that it wasn't buying what we thought it. It wasn't giving us what we thought it would give us. So the next, I got the opportunity to have about 3 or 4 years later, another project in almost the exact same domain, where we basically got a redo. It wasn't a rewrite. Like the first one shipped, it's in production today. In fact, I think I'll be heading up pretty soon another engagement with that exact same project I wrote 10 years ago. But we got a redo, basically a reset of just, okay, all these lessons we learned, what can we do next? And so that project was the first one that that Mediator was actually used in production. Because we looked at the first one and said, yeah, that what was valuable was the request response part. All the other pieces weren't really valuable to us. And so let's see how far we can get without any of those later attractions. And years later, we're still in use, and we haven't needed those later abstractions. So I said, well, then why use them at all? The other big lesson I learned from that first project was that part in the DDD book that no one ever gets to, the last third of it, where it talks about bounded context and strategic design. Usually everyone stops with the talk about structural patterns. That is, how do I code an entity? How do I code an aggregate? How do I code repository? That sort of thing. And so there's a ton of books on implementing DDD. So talking about all the code that you have to write. That first project that taught me, like, that part is almost negligible in its impact in the success of our project. What is super important, though, is getting the boundaries right. So we built that first project as one single app, one single entity. And so it does a whole bunch of stuff, but it's all very tied together. You could go look back now and say, oh, of course you shouldn't have built one single monolith for everything. But in reality, we weren't experienced enough to understand that we should be breaking these down to smaller chunks. Or at least we just didn't have the context, nor the contract to do so, because like we wouldn't have been able to get that approved like at all to build separate apps. But the second go around was different. We were able to break it down and say, you know, we're only going to build an app for this one group of folks. And for another group of folks, we'll build something different. And then we'll use integration to have those different things talk to each other. And this freed us up. And when we had different groups who clearly were using the same words, but they meant very different things, then we had those cases where we can't try to force all these different groups into one single model. So that was another just huge lesson I learned, was when it's very clear that two groups don't agree on meanings of terms, then they probably shouldn't be using the same system, because fundamentally those groups will never agree. So I see this all the time as people try to build, even building towards like microservice-based architectures, is trying to build services around the nouns in their system. That is, I have orders, so I will have an order service. Taking that database table that is the orders table. Let's now create the orders service, the orders repository, orders controller, wrap it all up together, and now I've got the order service. But what we see in practice, though, is that the business is less organized around nouns and more oriented around the workflow or the value stream. So I worked at Dell for about a year or so, and our organization was built around the workflow that a user went through when they were purchasing something. So there was a catalog team. There was we went through several name changes even within 11 months I was there. But it was basically the checkout order processing, cart checkout order processing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we had another team that was fulfillment, another one for shipping. And so we're really organized around the value stream the customer went through as opposed to the nouns in the system. Because you look at something like product, there was no product service because no one could agree what a product actually was. you see it on the web page, that's the product. You're like, well, once you put it in your cart, it takes on a different meaning because now the price is frozen. You can't change the price once it goes to cart, at least. Like, you really shouldn't. Like, no one wants to be surprised. Or all the way down to fulfillment. So everyone had a kind of different aspect or view, and there was no canonical product in the enterprise. And that was okay. When I see customers and clients trying to build their service boundaries around nouns, it goes back to the whole DDD bounded context thing, that you have this term in the ubiquitous language. It means different things to different people. And that's that signal that you shouldn't try to encapsulate all those into one bounded context or service, that they all have a different aspect or view of things. And you'll never get that one singular view except for, you know, maybe in some kind of data warehousing reporting system. So stop trying to do that. We saw it in action from the first system that was built for, one system for everyone, and then finally getting into individual systems for individual groups of folks where those boundaries made sense. And so that's the other really big thing that I had to learn in my career, is just how to draw those boundaries appropriately, and how to talk to the business to figure out where those boundaries are.
Yeah, I've seen that a lot, that people will read a concept and immediately start implementing it. And you learn so much with the first implementation about, maybe I did that a little wrong, or at least, I can approve that. Our team can approve that. We can mm-hmm. change this implementation and go about things differently because we know more now.
I can't even, I've been involved in every industry you can imagine, being in consulting for 10 years, I've touched it. But even when I have the same client from the same industry, we won't draw the boundaries the same. I've had one client that was a contract manufacturer. So they, built stuff for other people. And then another one that was actually manufactured products. And even though they're both like manufacturing, and I visited their facilities, they had completely different implementations for how they drew the boundaries for things, because ultimately their businesses were so different. So unless I have like two identical businesses with two identical structures, then I'm almost certainly not going to have the same boundaries for systems.
Cool. So one of the things we always ask everyone that comes on is to kind of give a little bit of advice. And you gave earlier some advice to people that were kind of getting started into refactoring patterns and that and whatnot. Would you speak a little bit to someone who is maybe trying to release their own open source? What kind of words of advice would you give to and point them? What kind of resources might you be able to point them to? Or,
oh man, besides like, don't.
I mean, that might be valid.
No, I see. I can definitely tell people to don't make the same mistakes I did with a lot of libraries, or a lot of the decisions I made with my libraries. Probably the biggest thing would be, don't go in with a lot of lofty expectations. I know I met some folks that get disappointed that their library isn't downloaded. And for me, that someone else uses it is just icing on the cake. The big thing is that, can I get use out of it? So if I can satisfy my primary customer, which is the people at this company, then that's good. The second big advice I have is don't put in features that you're not actually using, which seems silly. It's like an obvious piece of advice, but all the design mistakes I've seen from my libraries have really come from, I put in a feature optimistically, or just to be generous, to say this other person really enthusiastic and really wants this feature, and I want to please them, so I'll go incorporate their feature. But if I'm not using that feature, I'm not using that functionality, then I can't tell if it's a good idea or bad idea. I have to see it in actual use, because a lot of my libraries are so distanced from any kind of domain. I can't tell if it's going to be good or not. So, building something for actual real world use means you're going to be happier with it, because it's solving a problem that you have, and not trying to please people by putting in things that you wouldn't actually use or not going to use, because you will eventually regret somebody coming and asking you for support for that feature that you didn't write and you don't use. And you're like, I don't know.
All right. Very cool. How about if people just want to get a hold of you, or get, find out more about you, see what you're doing. Is there a social media plug or Twitter or something like that you'd like to plug?
Sure. Twitter is probably the easiest way. Cause I do answer mentions. Email as well, and I'll just have an email after this. Otherwise, you can find me on my blog, which is just my name.com, so jimmybogard.com. Those are the best ways to find what I'm doing and get a hold of me.
Cool. And then I know earlier you and I were talking, and you said you had an upcoming speaking engagement. Do you have any other, or what was that one? Would you mention that one now? And then anything else?
Oh, sure. So in a couple days, I'll be speaking at NDC Minnesota. So that's in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And I'll be speaking on distributed transactions, because we had a system, again, coming from a real world use, we had a system that was using MongoDB, which does not support transactions, at least at the time, did not support transactions across documents. And I was coming into a customer that just all over the place was like writing to multiple documents and not realizing like something can go wrong. And now I've got like half finished documents. So that one's about how do you solve the problem if you don't have transactions or distributed transactions? And then coming up after that, I'll be speaking at KCDC, the Kansas City Developer Conference in July. And that conference, which is in Wisconsin Dells, the Kalahari Water Park there, in August. I'll be speaking overseas a few places. I don't know if that matters to folks, but I'll be speaking at NDC Oslo also as in June. So yeah, a few coming up.
Well, thanks, Jimmy. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Jimmy Bogard. Jimmy is chief architect at Headspring, author of the MVC in Action books, international speaker, and prolific OSS developer. He is an expert in distributed systems, REST, messaging, domain-driven design, and CQRS.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I am John Ash. We'll